So the women swished their silks and laughed, and looking on their men with hearts bursting with pride, they knew that love snatched in the face of danger and death was doubly sweet for the strange excitement that went with it. When first she looked at the crowd, Scarlet's heart had thump-thumped with the unaccustomed excitement of being at a party. But as she half-comprehendingly saw the high-hearted look on the faces about her, her joy began to evaporate. Every woman present was blazing with an emotion she did not feel. It bewildered and depressed her. Somehow, the hall did not seem so pretty, nor the girls so dashing, and the white heat of devotion to the cause that was still shining on every face seemed... why, it just seemed silly. In a sudden flash of self-knowledge that made her mouth pop open with astonishment, she realized that she did not share with these women their fierce pride, their desire to sacrifice themselves and everything they had for the cause. Before horror made her think, "No, no, I mustn't think such things. They're wrong, sinful." She knew the cause meant nothing at all to her, and that she was bored with hearing other people talk about it with that fanatic look in their eyes. The cause didn't seem sacred to her. The war didn't seem to be a holy affair, but a nuisance that killed men senselessly and cost money and made luxuries hard to get. She saw that she was tired of the endless knitting and the endless bandage rolling and lint picking that roughened the cuticle of her nails. And, oh, she was so tired of the hospital. Tired and bored and nauseated with the sickening gangrene smells and the endless moaning, frightened by the look that coming death gave to sunken faces. She looked furtively around her as the treacherous, blasphemous thoughts rushed through her mind, fearful that someone might find them written clearly upon her face. Oh, why couldn't she feel like these other women? They were wholehearted and sincere in their devotion to the cause. They really meant everything they said and did. And if anyone should ever suspect that she... no, no one must ever know. She must go on making a pretense of enthusiasm and pride in the cause, which she could not feel, acting out her part of the widow of a Confederate officer who bears her grief bravely, whose heart is in the grave, who feels that her husband's death meant nothing if it aided the cause to triumph. Oh, why was she different, apart from these loving women? She could never love anything or anyone so selflessly as they did. What a lonely feeling it was. And she had never been lonely either in body or spirit before. At first she tried to stifle the thoughts, but the hard self-honesty that lay at the base of her nature would not permit it. And so, while the bazaar went on, while she and Melanie waited on the customers who came to their booth, her mind was busily working, trying to justify herself to herself, a task which she seldom found difficult. The other women were simply silly and hysterical with their talk of patriotism and the cause, and the men were almost as bad with their talk of vital issues and states' rights. She, Scarlett O'Hara Hamilton, alone had good, hard-headed Irish sense. She wasn't going to make a fool out of herself about the cause, but neither was she going to make a fool out of herself by admitting her true feelings. She was hard-headed enough to be practical about the situation, and no one would ever know how she felt. How surprised the bazaar would be if they knew what she really was thinking. How shocked if she suddenly climbed on the bandstand and declared that she thought the war ought to stop, so everybody could go home and tend to their cotton, and there could be parties and bows again, and plenty of pale green dresses. For a moment, her self-justification buoyed her up, but still she looked about the hall with distaste. The McClure girls' booth was inconspicuous, as Mrs. Merriweather had said, and there were long intervals when no one came to their corner, and Scarlet had nothing to do but look enviously on the happy throng. Melanie sensed her moodiness, but, crediting it to longing for Charlie, did not try to engage her in conversation. She busied herself arranging the articles in the booth in more attractive display, while Scarlet sat and looked glumly around the room. Even the banked flowers below the pictures of Mr. Davis and Mr. Stevens displeased her. "It looks like an altar," she sniffed. "And the way they all carry on about those two, they might as well be the father and the son." Then, smitten with sudden fright at her irreverence, she began hastily to cross herself by way of apology, but caught herself in time. "Well, it's true," she argued with her conscience. "Everybody carries on like they were holy, and they aren't anything but men, and mighty unattractive-looking ones at that." Of course, Mr. Stevens couldn't help how he looked, for he had been an invalid all his life. But Mr. Davis... She looked up at the cameo, clean, proud face. It was his goatee that annoyed her the most. Men should either be clean-shaven, mustached, or wear full beards. "That little wisp looks like it was just the best he could do," she thought, not seeing in his face the cold, hard intelligence that was carrying the weight of a new nation. No, she was not happy now. And at first she had been radiant with the pleasure of being in a crowd. Now just being present was not enough. She was at the bazaar, but not a part of it. No one paid her any attention, and she was the only young unmarried woman present who did not have a beau. And all her life she had enjoyed the center of the stage. It wasn't fair. She was 17 years old, and her feet were patting the floor, wanting to skip and dance. She was 17 years old, and she had a husband lying at Oakland Cemetery, and a baby in his cradle at Aunt Pettipat's, and everyone thought she should be content with her lot. She had a whiter bosom, and a smaller waist, and a tinier foot than any girl present. But for all they mattered, she might just as well be lying beside Charles with "beloved wife of" carved over her. She wasn't a girl who could dance and flirt, and she wasn't a wife who could sit with other wives and criticize the dancing and flirting girls. And she wasn't old enough to be a widow. Widows should be old. So terribly old they didn't want to dance and flirt and be admired. Oh, it wasn't fair that she should have to sit here primly and be the acme of widowed dignity and propriety when she was only 17. It wasn't fair that she must keep her voice low and her eyes cast modestly down when men, attractive ones too, came to their booth. Every girl in Atlanta was 3 deep in men. Even the plainest girls were carrying on like belles. And, oh, worst of all, they were carrying on in such lovely, lovely dresses. Here she sat like a crow with hot black taffeta to her wrists and buttoned up to her chin, with not even a hint of lace or braid. Not a jewel except Ellen's onyx mourning brooch, watching tacky-looking girls hanging on the arms of good-looking men. All because Charles Hamilton had had the measles. He didn't even die in a fine glow of gallantry in battle, so she could brag about him. Rebelliously, she leaned her elbows on the counter and looked at the crowd, flouting Mammy's oft-repeated admonition against leaning on elbows and making them ugly and wrinkled. What did it matter if they did get ugly? She'd probably never get a chance to show them again. She looked hungrily at the frocks floating by, butter-yellow watered silks with garlands of rosebuds, pink satins with 18 flounces edged with tiny black velvet ribbons, baby blue taffeta 10 yards in the skirt and foamy with cascading lace, exposed bosoms, seductive flowers. Maybell Merriweather went toward the next booth on the arm of the zouave, in an apple-green tarlatan so wide that it reduced her waist to nothingness. It was showered and flounced with cream-colored Chantilly lace that had come from Charleston on the last blockader, and Maybelle was flaunting it as saucily as if she, and not the famous Captain Butler, had run the blockade. "How sweet I'd look in that dress," thought Scarlet, a savage envy in her heart. "Her waist is as big as a cow's. That green is just my color, and it would make my eyes look... Why will blondes try to wear that color? Her skin looks as green as an old cheese. And to think I'll never wear that color again. Not even when I do get out of mourning. No, not even if I do manage to get married again. Then I'll have to wear tacky old grays and tans and lilacs." For a brief moment, she considered the unfairness of it all. How short was the time for fun, for pretty clothes, for dancing, for coquetting? Only a few, too few years. Then you married and wore dull-colored dresses and had babies that ruined your waistline and sat in corners at dances with other sober matrons and only emerged to dance with your husband or with old gentlemen who stepped on your feet. If you didn't do these things, the other matrons talked about you, and then your reputation was ruined and your family disgraced. It seemed such a terrible waste to spend all your little girlhood learning how to be attractive and how to catch men, and then only use the knowledge for a year or two. When she considered her training at the hands of Ellen and Mammy, she knew it had been thorough and good because it had always reaped results. There were set rules to be followed, and if you followed them, success crowned your efforts. With old ladies, you were sweet and guileless, and appeared as simple-minded as possible, for old ladies were sharp, and they watched girls as jealously as cats, ready to pounce on any indiscretion of tongue or eye. With old gentlemen, a girl was pert and saucy and almost, but not quite, flirtatious, so that the old fool's vanities would be tickled. It made them feel devilish and young, and they pinched your cheek and declared you were a minx. And of course you always blushed on such occasions, otherwise they would pinch you with more pleasure than was proper, and then tell their sons that you were fast. With young girls and young married women, you slopped over with sugar and kissed them every time you met them, even if it was 10 times a day. And you put your arms around their waists and suffered them to do the same to you, no matter how much you disliked it. You admired their frocks or their babies indiscriminately, and teased about beaux and complimented husbands and giggled modestly, and denied that you had any charms at all compared with theirs. And above all, you never said what you really thought about anything, any more than they said what they really thought. Other women's husbands you let severely alone, even if they were your own discarded beaux, and no matter how temptingly attractive they were. If you were too nice to young husbands, their wives said you were fast and you got a bad reputation and never caught any beaux of your own. But with young bachelors, ah, that was a different matter. You could laugh softly at them, and when they came flying to see why you laughed, you could refuse to tell them and laugh harder, and keep them around indefinitely trying to find out. You could promise with your eyes any number of exciting things that would make a man maneuver to get you alone. And having gotten you alone, you could be very, very hurt, or very, very angry when he tried to kiss you. You could make him apologize for being a cur, and forgive him so sweetly that he would hang around trying to kiss you a second time. Sometimes, but not often, you did let him kiss you. Ellen and Mammy had not taught her that, but she learned it was effective. Then you cried and declared you didn't know what had come over you, and that he couldn't ever respect you again. Then he had to dry your eyes, and usually he proposed, to show just how much he did respect you. And then there were, oh, there were so many things to do to bachelors, and she knew them all. The nuance of the sidelong glance, the half-smile behind the fan, the swaying of the hips so that skirt swung like a bell, the tears, the laughter, the flattery, the sweet sympathy. Oh, all the tricks that never failed to work, except with Ashley. No, it didn't seem right to learn all these smart tricks, use them so briefly, and then put them away forever. How wonderful it would be never to marry, but to go on being lovely in pale green dresses and forever courted by handsome men. But if you went on too long, you got to be an old maid like India Wilkes, and everyone said poor thing in that smug, hateful way. No, after all, it was better to marry and keep your self-respect, even if you never had any more fun. Oh, what a mess life was! Why had she been such an idiot as to marry Charles of all people and have her life end at 16? Her indignant and hopeless reverie was broken when the crowd began pushing back against the walls, the ladies carefully holding their hoops so that no careless contact should turn them up against their bodies and show more pantalettes than was proper. Scarlet tiptoed above the crowd and saw the captain of the militia mounting the orchestra platform. He shouted orders and half of the company fell into line. For a few minutes they went through a brisk drill that brought perspiration to their foreheads and cheers and applause from the audience. Scarlet clapped her hands dutifully with the rest, and as the soldiers pushed forward toward the punch and lemonade booths after they were dismissed, she turned to Melanie, feeling that she had better begin her deception about the cause as soon as possible. "They looked fine, didn't they?" she said. Melanie was fussing about with the knitted things on the counter. "Most of them would look a lot finer in gray uniforms and in Virginia," she said, and she did not trouble to lower her voice. Several of the proud mothers of members of the militia were standing close by and overheard the remark. Mrs. Guinan turned scarlet and then white, for her 25-year-old Willie was in the company. Scarlet was aghast at such words coming from Melly of all people. "Why, Melly!" "You know it's true, Scarlet. I don't mean the little boys and the old gentlemen, but a lot of the militia are perfectly able to tote a rifle, and that's what they ought to be doing this minute." But, began Scarlet, who had never considered the matter before. "Somebody's got to stay home to—" What was it Willie Guinan had told her by way of excusing his presence in Atlanta? "Somebody's got to stay home to protect the state from invasion." "Nobody's invading us, and nobody's going to," said Melly coolly, looking toward a group of the militia. "And the best way to keep out invaders is to go to Virginia and beat the Yankees there. And as for all this talk about the militia staying here to keep the darkies from rising, why, it's the silliest thing I ever heard of. Why should our people rise? It's just a good excuse for cowards. I'll bet we could lick the Yankees in a month if all the militia of all the states went to Virginia. So there." "Why, Melly!" cried Scarlet again, staring. Melly's soft, dark eyes were flashing angrily. "My husband wasn't afraid to go, and neither was yours. And I'd rather they'd both be dead than here at home. Oh, darling, I'm sorry. How thoughtless and cruel of me." She stroked Scarlet's arm appealingly, and Scarlet stared at her. But it was not of dead Charles she was thinking. It was of Ashley. Suppose he, too, were to die. She turned quickly and smiled automatically as Dr. Meade walked up to their booth. "Well, girls," he greeted them, "it was nice of you to come. I know what a sacrifice it must have been for you to come out tonight, but it's all for the cause. And I'm going to tell you a secret. I've a surprise way for making some more money tonight for the hospital, but I'm afraid some of the ladies are going to be shocked about it." He stopped and chuckled as he tugged at his gray goatee. Oh, what? Do tell.
On second thought, I believe I'll keep you guessing too. But you girls must stand up for me if the church members want to run me out of town for doing it. However, it's for the hospital. You see, nothing like this has ever been done before.
He went off pompously toward a group of chaperones in one corner, and just as the two girls had turned to each other to discuss the possibilities of the secret, two old gentlemen bore down on the booth, declaring in loud voices that they wanted 10 miles of tatting. Well, after all, old gentlemen were better than no gentlemen at all, thought Scarlet, measuring out the tatting and submitting demurely to being chucked under the chin. The old blades charged off toward the lemonade booth, and others took their places at the counter. Their booth did not have so many customers as did the other booths where the tootling laugh of Maybelle Merriweather sounded, and Fanny Elsing's giggles and the Whiting girls' repartee made merriment. Melly sold useless stuff to men who could have no possible use for it as quietly and serenely as a shopkeeper. And Scarlet patterned her conduct on Melly's. There were crowds in front of every other counter but theirs, girls chattering, men buying. The few who came to them talked about how they went to the university with Ashley, and what a fine soldier he was, or spoke in respectful tones of Charles and how great a loss to Atlanta his death had been. Then the music broke into the rollicking strains of Johnny Booker, Hep Dis Nigger, and Scarlet thought she would scream. She wanted to dance. She wanted to dance. She looked across the floor and tapped her foot to the music, and her green eyes blazed so eagerly that they fairly snapped. All the way across the floor, a man, newly come and standing in the doorway, saw them, started in recognition, and watched closely the slanting eyes in the sulky, rebellious face. Then he grinned to himself as he recognized the invitation that any male could read. He was dressed in black broadcloth, a tall man, towering over the officers who stood near him. Bulky in the shoulders, but tapering to a small waist, and absurdly small feet in varnished boots. His severe black suit, with fine ruffled shirt and trousers smartly strapped beneath high insteps, was oddly at variance with his physique and face, for he was foppishly groomed, the clothes of a dandy on a body that was powerful and latently dangerous in its lazy grace. His hair was jet black, and his black mustache was small and closely clipped, almost foreign-looking compared with the dashing, swooping mustaches of the cavalryman nearby. He looked, and was, a man of lusty and unashamed appetites. He had an air of utter assurance, of displeasing insolence about him, and there was a twinkle of malice in his bold eyes as he stared at Scarlet, until finally, feeling his gaze, she looked toward him. Somewhere in her mind, the bell of recognition rang, but for the moment she could not recall who he was. But he was the first man in months who had displayed an interest in her, and she threw him a gay smile. She made a little curtsy as he bowed, and then, as he straightened and started toward her, with a peculiarly lithe Indian-like gait, her hand went to her mouth in horror, for she knew who he was. Thunderstruck, she stood as if paralyzed while he made his way through the crowd. Then she turned blindly, bent on flight into the refreshment rooms, but her skirt caught on a nail of the booth. She jerked furiously at it, tearing it, and in an instant he was beside her. "Permit me," he said, bending over and disentangling the flounce. "I hardly hoped that you would recall me, Miss O'Hara." His voice was oddly pleasant to the ear, the well-modulated voice of a gentleman, resonant and overlaid with a flat, slow drawl of the Charlestonian. She looked up at him imploringly, her face crimson with the shame of their last meeting, and met two of the blackest eyes she had ever seen, dancing in merciless merriment. Of all the people in the world to turn up here, this terrible person who had witnessed that scene with Ashley which still gave her nightmares, this odious wretch who ruined girls and was not received by nice people, this despicable man who had said, and with good cause, that she was not a lady. At the sound of his voice, Melanie turned, and for the first time in her life, Scarlett thanked God for the existence of her sister-in-law. "Why, it's Mr. Rhett Butler, isn't it?" said Melanie with a little smile, putting out her hand. "I met you
on the happy occasion of the announcement of your betrothal," he finished, bending over her hand. "It is kind of you to recall me."
"And what are you doing so far from Charleston, Mr. Butler?"
"A boring matter of business, Mrs. Wilkes. I will be in and out of your town from now on. I find I must not only bring in goods, but see to the disposal of them."
"Bring in," began Melly, her brow wrinkling, and then she broke into a delighted smile. "Why, you must be the famous Captain Butler we've been hearing so much about, the blockade runner. Why, every girl here is wearing dresses you brought in. Scarlett, aren't you thrilled? What's the matter, dear? Are you faint? Do sit down." Scarlett sank to the stool, her breath coming so rapidly she feared the lacings of her stays would burst. Oh, what a terrible thing to happen! She had never thought to meet this man again. He picked up her black fan from the counter and began fanning her solicitously. Too solicitously. His face grave, but his eyes still dancing. "It is quite warm in here," he said. "No wonder Miss O'Hara is faint. May I lead you to a window?" "No,"
said Scarlett, so rudely that Melly stared.
"She is not Miss O'Hara any longer," said Melly. "She is Mrs. Hamilton. She is my sister now."
And Melly bestowed one of her fond little glances on her. Scarlett felt that she would strangle at the expression on Captain Butler's swarthy, piratical face. "I am sure that is a great gain to two charming ladies," said he, making a slight bow. That was the kind of remark all men made. But when he said it, it seemed to her that he meant just the opposite. "Your two husbands are here tonight, I trust, on this happy occasion. It would be a pleasure to renew acquaintances."
"My husband is in Virginia," said Melly with a proud lift of her head. "But Charles..." Her voice broke.
"He died in camp," said Scarlett flatly. She almost snapped the words. Would this creature never go away? Melly looked at her, startled, and the captain made a gesture of self-reproach. "My dear ladies, how could I? You must forgive me. But permit a stranger to offer a comfort of saying that to die for one's country is to live forever." Melanie smiled at him through sparkling tears, while Scarlett felt the fox of wrath and impotent hate gnaw at her vitals. Again he had made a graceful remark, the kind of compliment any gentleman would pay under such circumstances, but he did not mean a word of it. He was jeering at her. He knew she hadn't loved Charles. And Melly was just a big enough fool not to see through him. "Oh, please, God, don't let anybody else see through him," she thought with a start of terror. Would he tell what he knew? Of course he wasn't a gentleman, and there was no telling what men would do when they weren't gentlemen.
There was no standard to judge them by. She looked up at him and saw that his mouth was pulled down at the corners in mock sympathy, even while he swished the fan. Something in his look challenged her spirit and brought her strength back in a surge of dislike. Abruptly, she snatched the fan from his hand. "I'm quite all right," she said tartly. "There's no need to blow my hair out of place."
"Scarlet, darling. Captain Butler, you must forgive her. She isn't herself when she hears poor Charlie's name spoken, and perhaps after all we shouldn't have come here tonight. We're still in mourning, you see, and it's quite a strain on her, all this gaiety and music, poor child."
"I quite understand," he said, with elaborate gravity. But as he turned and gave Melanie a searching look that went to the bottom of her sweet, worried eyes, his expression changed, reluctant respect and gentleness coming over his dark face.
"I think you're a courageous little lady, Mrs. Wilkes."
"Not a word about me," thought Scarlet indignantly, as Mellie smiled in confusion and answered, "Dear me, no, Captain Butler. The hospital committee just had to have us for this booth because at the last minute... A pillowcase? Here's a lovely one with a flag on it."
She turned to three cavalrymen who appeared at her counter. For a moment, Melanie thought how nice Captain Butler was. Then she wished that something more substantial than cheesecloth was between her skirt and the spittoon that stood just outside the booth, for the aim of the horsemen with amber streams of tobacco juice was not so unerring as with their long horse pistols. Then she forgot about the captain, Scarlet, and the spittoons as more customers crowded to her. Scarlet sat quietly on the stool, fanning herself, not daring to look up, wishing Captain Butler back on the deck of his ship where he belonged.
"Your husband has been dead long?"
"Oh, yes, a long time. Almost a year."
"An eon, I'm sure."
Scarlet was not sure what an eon was, but there was no mistaking the baiting quality of his voice, so she said nothing.
"Had you been married long? Forgive my questions, but I have been away from this section for so long."
2 months, said Scarlet unwillingly.
"A tragedy, no less," his easy voice continued.
Oh, damn him, she thought violently. If he was any other man in the world, I could simply freeze up and order him off. But he knows about Ashley, and he knows I didn't love Charlie. And my hands are tied. She said nothing, still looking down at her fan.
"And this is your first social appearance?"
"I know it looks quite odd," she explained rapidly, "but the McClure girls who were to take this booth were called away, and there was no one else, so Melanie and I—"
"No sacrifice is too great for the cause."
Why, that was what Mrs. Elsing had said, but when she said it, it didn't sound the same way. Hot words started to her lips, but she choked them back. After all, she was here not for the cause, but because she was tired of sitting at home.
"I have always thought," he said reflectively, "that the system of mourning, of immuring women in crape for the rest of their lives and forbidding them normal enjoyment, is just as barbarous as the Hindu sati."
"Sati?"
He laughed, and she blushed for her ignorance. She hated people who used words unknown to her.
"In India, when a man dies, he is burned instead of buried. And his wife always climbs on the funeral pyre and is burned with him."
"How dreadful! Why do they do it? Don't the police do anything about it?"
"Of course not. A wife who didn't burn herself would be a social outcast.
All the worthy Hindu matrons would talk about her for not behaving as a well-bred lady should, precisely as those worthy matrons in the corner would talk about you, should you appear tonight in a red dress and lead a reel. Personally, I think suttee much more merciful than our charming southern custom of burying widows alive.
How dare you say I'm buried alive?
How closely women clutch the very chains that bind them. You think the Hindu custom barbarous, but would you have had the courage to appear tonight if the Confederacy hadn't needed you?
Arguments of this character were always confusing to Scarlet. His were doubly confusing because she had a vague idea there was truth in them. But now was the time to squelch him. Of course I wouldn't have come. It would have been, well, disrespectful to... It would have seemed as if I hadn't lo...
His eyes waited on her words, cynical amusement in them, and she could not go on. He knew she hadn't loved Charlie, and he wouldn't let her pretend to the nice, polite sentiments that she should express. What a terrible, terrible thing it was to have to do with a man who wasn't a gentleman. A gentleman always appeared to believe a lady, even when he knew she was lying. That was Southern chivalry. A gentleman always obeyed the rules and said the correct things and made life easier for a lady. But this man seemed not to care for rules and evidently enjoyed talking of things no one ever talked about.
I am waiting breathlessly.
I think you are horrid, she said, helplessly, dropping her eyes. He leaned down across the counter until his mouth was near her ear and hissed, in a very creditable imitation of the stage villains who appeared infrequently at the Athenaeum Hall.
Fear not, fair lady. Your guilty secret is safe with me.
Oh! She whispered feverishly. How can you say such things?
I only thought to ease your mind. What would you have me say? Be mine, beautiful female, or I will reveal all.
She met his eyes unwillingly, and saw they were as teasing as a small boy's. Suddenly she laughed. It was such a silly situation, after all.
He laughed, too, and so loudly that several of the chaperones in the corner looked their way. Observing how good a time Charles Hamilton's widow appeared to be having with a perfect stranger, they put their heads together disapprovingly.
There was a roll of drums, and many voices cried, "Shh!" as Dr. Meade mounted the platform and spread out his arms for quiet.
We must all give grateful thanks to the charming ladies whose indefatigable and patriotic efforts have made this bazaar not only a pecuniary success, he began, but have transformed this rough hall into a bower of loveliness, a fit garden for the charming rosebuds I see about me.
Everyone clapped approvingly.
The ladies have given their best, not only of their time, but of the labor of their hands, and these beautiful objects in the booths are doubly beautiful, made as they are by the fair hands of our charming southern women.
There were more shouts of approval, and Rhett Butler, who had been lounging negligently against the counter at Scarlet's side, whispered,
"Pompous goat, isn't he?"
Startled, at first horrified, at this least majesty toward Atlanta's most beloved citizen, she stared reprovingly at him. But the doctor did look like a goat, with his gray chin whiskers wagging away at a great rate, and with difficulty she stifled a giggle.
"But these things are not enough.
The good ladies of the hospital committee, whose cool hands have soothed many a suffering brow and brought back from the jaws of death our brave men wounded in the bravest of all causes, know our needs. I will not enumerate them. We must have more money to buy medical supplies from England. And we have with us tonight the intrepid captain who has so successfully run the blockade for a year, and who will run it again to bring us the drugs we need. Captain Rhett Butler. Though caught unawares, the blockader made a graceful bow. Too graceful, thought Scarlet, trying to analyze it. It was almost as if he overdid his courtesy because his contempt for everybody present was so great. There was a loud burst of applause as he bowed, and a craning of necks from the ladies in the corner. So that was who poor Charles Hamilton's widow was carrying on with, and Charlie hardly dead a year. We need more gold, and I am asking you for it. The doctor continued. I am asking a sacrifice, but a sacrifice so small, compared with the sacrifices our gallant men in gray are making, that it will seem laughably small. Ladies, I want your jewelry. I want your jewelry. No, the Confederacy wants your jewelry. The Confederacy calls for it, and I know no one will hold back. How fair a gem gleams on a lovely wrist. How beautifully gold brooches glitter on the bosoms of our patriotic women. But how much more beautiful is sacrifice than all the gold and gems of the Ind. The gold will be melted and the stones sold and the money used to buy drugs and other medical supplies. Ladies, there will pass among you two of our gallant wounded with baskets, and... But the rest of his speech was lost in the storm and tumult of clapping hands and cheering voices. Scarlet's first thought was one of deep thankfulness that mourning forbade her wearing her precious earbobs and the heavy gold chain that had been Grandma Robillard's and the gold and black enameled bracelets and the garnet brooch. She saw the little zouave, a split oak basket over his unwounded arm, making the rounds of the crowd on her side of the hall, and saw women, old and young, laughing, eager, tugging at bracelets, squealing in pretended pain as earrings came from pierced flesh, helping each other undo stiff necklace clasps, unpinning brooches from bosoms. There was a steady little clink-clink of metal on metal and cries of, "Wait, wait, I've got it unfastened now. There." Maybelle Merriweather was pulling off her lovely twin bracelets from above and below her elbows. Fanny Elsing, crying, "Mama, may I?" was tearing from her curls the seed pearl ornament set in heavy gold, which had been in the family for generations. As each offering went into the basket, there was applause and cheering. The grinning little man was coming to their booth now, his basket heavy on his arm. And as he passed Rhett Butler, a handsome gold cigar case was thrown carelessly into the basket. When he came to Scarlet and rested his basket upon the counter, she shook her head, throwing wide her hands to show that she had nothing to give. It was embarrassing to be the only person present who was giving nothing. And then she saw the bright gleam of her wide gold wedding ring. For a confused moment she tried to remember Charles's face, how he had looked when he slipped it on her finger. But the memory was blurred by the sudden feeling of irritation that memory of him always brought to her. Charles. He was the reason why life was over for her, why she was an old woman. With a sudden wrench, she seized the ring, but it stuck. The zouave was moving toward Melanie. "Wait," cried Scarlet. "I have something for you." The ring came off, and As she started to throw it into the basket, heaped up with chains, watches, rings, pins, and bracelets, she caught Rhett Butler's eye. His lips were twisted in a slight smile. Defiantly, she tossed the ring onto the top of the pile.
"Oh, my darling," whispered Melly, clutching her arm, her eyes blazing with love and pride. "You brave, brave girl. Wait. Please wait, Lieutenant Picard. I have something for you, too."
She was tugging at her own wedding ring. The ring Scarlet knew had never once left that finger since Ashley put it there. Scarlet knew, as no one did, how much it meant to her. It came off with difficulty, and for a brief instant was clutched tightly in the small palm. Then it was laid gently on the pile of jewelry. The two girls stood looking after the Zouave, who was moving toward the group of elderly ladies in the corner. Scarlet, defiant. Melanie with a look more pitiful than tears. And neither expression was lost on the man who stood beside them.
"If you hadn't been brave enough to do it, I would never have been either," said Melly, putting her arm about Scarlet's waist and giving her a gentle squeeze. For a moment, Scarlet wanted to shake her off and cry, "Name of God!"
at the top of her lungs, as Gerald did when he was irritated. But she caught Rhett Butler's eye and managed a very sour smile. It was annoying the way Melly always misconstrued her motives. But perhaps that was far preferable to having her suspect the truth.
"What a beautiful gesture," said Rhett Butler softly. "It is such sacrifices as yours that hearten our brave lads in grey."
Hot words bubbled to her lips, and it was with difficulty that she checked them. There was mockery in everything he said. She disliked him heartily, lounging there against the booth. But there was something stimulating about him, something warm and vital and electric. All that was Irish in her rose to the challenge of his black eyes. She decided she was going to take this man down a notch or two. His knowledge of her secret gave him an advantage over her that was exasperating, so she would have to change that by putting him at a disadvantage somehow. She stifled her impulse to tell him exactly what she thought of him. Sugar always caught more flies than vinegar, as Mammy often said, and she was going to catch and subdue this fly, so he could never again have her at his mercy.
"Thank you," she said sweetly, deliberately misunderstanding his jibe. "A compliment like that coming from so famous a man as Captain Butler is appreciated."
He threw back his head and laughed freely. "Yelped," was what Scarlet thought fiercely, her face becoming pink again.
"Why don't you say what you really think?"
he demanded, lowering his voice so that in the clatter and excitement of the collection it came only to her ears.
"Why don't you say I'm a damned rascal and no gentleman, and that I must take myself off, or you'll have one of these gallant boys in grey call me out?"
It was on the tip of her tongue to answer tartly, but she managed by heroic control to say,
"Why, Captain Butler, how you do run on! As if everybody didn't know how famous you are, and how brave, and what a...
"I am disappointed in you," he said.
"Disappointed?"
"Yes. On the occasion of our first eventful meeting, I thought to myself that I had at last met a girl who was not only beautiful, but who had courage. And now I see that you are only beautiful."
"Do you mean to call me a coward?"
She was ruffling like a hen.
"Exactly. You lack the courage to say what you really think. When I first met you, I thought, there's a girl in a million. She isn't like these other silly little fools who believe everything their mamas tell them and act on it, no matter how they feel, and conceal all their feelings and desires and little heartbreaks behind a lot of sweet words. I thought, Miss O'Hara is a girl of rare spirit. She knows what she wants, and she doesn't mind speaking her mind, or throwing vases.
Oh, she said, rage breaking through. Then I'll speak my mind right this minute. If you had any raising at all, you'd never have come over here and talked to me. You'd have known I never wanted to lay eyes on you again. But you aren't a gentleman. You are just a nasty, ill-bred creature. And you think that because your rotten little boats can outrun the Yankees, you've got a right to come here and jeer at men who are brave and women who are sacrificing everything for the cause. Stop! Stop! He begged with a grin.
You started off very nicely and said what you thought, but don't begin talking to me about the cause. I'm tired of hearing about it, and I'll bet you are, too.
Well, how did... She began, caught off her balance, and then checked herself hastily, boiling with anger at herself for falling into his trap.
I stood there in the doorway before you saw me, and I watched you, he said. And I watched the other girls. And they all looked as though their faces came out of one mold. Yours didn't. You have an easy face to read. You didn't have your mind on your business, and I'll wager you weren't thinking about our cause or the hospital. It was all over your face that you wanted to dance and have a good time, and you couldn't. So you were mad clean through. Tell the truth. Am I not right?
I have nothing more to say to you, Captain Butler, she said as formally as she could, trying to draw the rags of her dignity about her. Just because you are conceited at being the great blockader doesn't give you the right to insult women.
The great blockader. That's a joke. Pray give me only one moment more of your precious time before you cast me into darkness. I wouldn't want so charming a little patriot to be left under a misapprehension about my contribution to the Confederate cause.
I don't care to listen to your brags.
Blockading is a business with me, and I'm making money out of it. When I stop making money out of it, I'll quit. What do you think of that?
I think you're a mercenary rascal, just like the Yankees.
Exactly, he grinned. And the Yankees helped me make my money. Why, last month, I sailed my boat right into New York Harbor and took on a cargo.
What? Cried Scarlet, interested and excited in spite of herself. Didn't they shell you?
My poor innocent, of course not. There are plenty of sturdy Union patriots who are not averse to picking up money selling goods to the Confederacy. I run my boat into New York, buy from Yankee firms, Sub Rosa, of course, and away I go. And when that gets a bit dangerous, I go to Nassau, where these same Union patriots have brought powder and shells and hoop skirts for me. It's more convenient than going to England. Sometimes it's a bit difficult running it into Charleston or Wilmington. But you'd be surprised how far a little gold goes.
Oh, I knew Yankees were vile, but I didn't know.
Why quibble about the Yankees earning an honest penny selling out the Union? It won't matter in 100 years. The result will be the same. They know the Confederacy will be licked eventually, so why shouldn't they cash in on it?
Licked? Us?
Of course.
Will you please leave me? Or will it be necessary for me to call my carriage and go home to get rid of you?
A red-hot little rebel, he said, with another sudden grin.
He bowed and sauntered off, leaving her with her bosom heaving with impotent rage and indignation. There was disappointment burning in her that she could not quite analyze. The disappointment of a child seeing illusions crumble. How dared he take the glamour from the blockaders? And how dared he say the Confederacy would be licked? He should be shot for that, shot like a traitor. She looked about the hall at the familiar faces, so assured of success, so brave, so devoted, and somehow a cold little chill set in at her heart. Licked? These people? Why, of course not. The very idea was impossible. Disloyal. "What were you two whispering about?" asked Melanie, turning to Scarlett as her customers drifted off. "I couldn't help seeing that Mrs. Merriweather had her eye on you all the time, and, dear, you know how she talks." "Oh, the man's impossible. An ill-bred boor," said Scarlett. "And as for old Lady Merriweather, let her talk. I'm sick of acting like a ninny, just for her benefit." "Why, Scarlett!" cried Melanie, scandalized. "Shh," said Scarlett. "Dr. Meade is going to make another announcement." The gathering quieted again as the doctor raised his voice, at first in thanks to the ladies who had so willingly given their jewelry. "And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to propose a surprise. An innovation that may shock some of you, but I ask you to remember that all this is done for the hospital and for the benefit of our boys lying there." Everyone edged forward in anticipation, trying to imagine what the sedate doctor could propose that would be shocking. "The dancing is about to begin, and the first number will, of course, be a reel, followed by a waltz. The dances following, the polkas, the schottisches, the mazurkas, will be preceded by short reels. I know the gentle rivalry to lead the reels very well, and so..." The doctor mopped his brow and cast a quizzical glance at the corner, where his wife sat among the chaperones. "Gentlemen, if you wish to lead a reel with a lady of your choice, you must bargain for her. I will be auctioneer, and the proceeds will go to the hospital." Fans stopped in mid-swish, and a ripple of excited murmuring ran through the hall. The chaperone's corner was in tumult, and Mrs. Meade, anxious to support her husband in an action of which she heartily disapproved, was at a disadvantage. Mrs. Elsing, Mrs. Merriweather, and Mrs. Whiting were red with indignation. But suddenly the home guard gave a cheer, and it was taken up by the other uniformed guests. The young girls clapped their hands and jumped excitedly. "Don't you think it's just a little like a slave auction?" whispered Melanie, staring uncertainly at the embattled doctor, who heretofore had been perfect in her eyes. Scarlett said nothing, but her eyes glittered, and her heart contracted with a little pain. If only she were not a widow! If only she were Scarlett O'Hara again, out there on the floor in an apple-green dress, with dark green velvet ribbons dangling from her bosom, and tuberoses in her black hair. She'd lead that reel. Yes, indeed. There'd be a dozen men battling for her and paying over money to the doctor. Oh, to have to sit here a wallflower against her will and see Fanny or Maybelle lead the first reel as the Belle of Atlanta. Above the tumult sounded the voice of the little Zouave, his Creole accent very obvious. "If I may... $20 for Miss Maybelle Merriweather." Maybelle collapsed with blushes against Fanny's shoulder, and the two girls hid their faces in each other's necks and giggled, as other voices began calling other names, other amounts of money. Dr. Meade had begun to smile again, ignoring completely the indignant whispers that came from the ladies' hospital committee in the corner. At first, Mrs. Merriweather had stated flatly and loudly that her Maybelle would never take part in such a proceeding. But as Maybelle's name was called most often, and the amount went up to $75, her protests began to dwindle. Scarlet leaned her elbows on the counter and almost glared at the excited, laughing crowd,